Good morning. This is Fran Michel here with Sandra Comstock. Sandra is the founder and executive director of Hygiene for All, which provides services including showers and laundry for unhoused people. And she's on the steering committee of the Welcome Home Coalition, which advocates for policies that address the root causes of the housing crisis. Dr. Comstock holds a PhD in sociology from Cornell University and has recently prepared studies on the state of our affordability and homelessness crisis in Portland Metro and Oregon, and on the 2024 performance of Multnomah County housing and sheltering strategies. Thank you for joining us on the Old Mole, Sandra Comstock.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here. I don't know if I'd call them studies, but they're sort of white papers to help inform people. So they're rougher than an actual study, but they're based on obviously the data that's available.
Your paper on the state of our affordability and homelessness crisis in Portland and Oregon points out that we're seeing funding cuts to housing supports from the federal, the state, the county, the city levels. Can you take us through what those funding sources were providing and how the cuts will impact people?
Okay, well, we can start at the biggest level, which is a federal level. Basically, HUD is the main source of housing vouchers, and they come in different forms, like Section 8, that people have heard of. Those are long-term housing vouchers typically, and they help to provide assistance for people to pay their rent so that people are paying no more than 30% of their income in rent. And in this last congressional session, when they did their big, brutal bill, they basically declined to stabilize housing vouchers. So housing expenses are going up and up. So if you don't increase the money to match that, then people lose those housing vouchers. And a National Homeless Law Center estimates a 5 to 10% of Oregonians will lose their housing vouchers due to these cuts. So we're looking at 5 to 10% of Oregonians that are dependent on these housing vouchers to make ends meet, having to lose their stability, their housing, possibly. So that's a big deal. The state legislature also reduced eviction prevention investments from 173 million to 33.6 million. And they've approved $1 billion in cuts to housing assistance over the next biennium. So this is at the same time that they're increasing money that they're funding for shelter. Now, the problem with this is shelter doesn't leave someone housed, and shelter is not really a sustainable way to live over a long period of time, particularly when it's congregate shelter. So you're going to just see more people on the streets, there's no doubt. And even in the last point in time count, I think over a third of people reported being houseless for the first time in their lives. So really, this is a housing crisis. This is a housing affordability crisis. Let's be clear. That's what causes this. And really, we're looking at a massive influx of people that are going to be unhoused. Shelters do not solve the problem. They just sort of hide it away, and not very well at that.
My understanding is that the cost of rent has nationwide has gone up 22% year over year. Income has clearly not gone up at that rate. So housing is becoming more expensive. The support that bridges the gap between income and rent is not being maintained. And so more people are losing their housing, ending up out on the street.
There's just a lot of different pressures taking place, both, the lack of construction, but also the lack of public ownership or community trust ownership of land that keeps things out of the market. The market is just not a great distributor. If you're looking for a profit continually through renting to people, the rates are going to go up. They're not going to invest money unless there's a large profit. And another pressure is the AI algorithms now that will evaluate for a property owner what the market will bear, basically, before you're going to lose money. So that can even involve leaving units empty and charging more to keep the prices artificially high. You could actually make more money keeping places empty and renting at higher rates. So that's a real problem.
So the drive for profit is maintaining this cycle of increasing cost for rent. Housing vouchers, while essential in keeping people in their homes, it seems to me are kind of rewarding that since they are going from public funds through people who need help with assistance back to landlords who are then able to keep their rents high and rising. because their tenants are being subsidized, or because,
Yes.
as you say, they're happy to leave something empty if they can get more money for another
Right.
unit.
And this is true, but at the same time, we can purchase buildings that are already built, which is actually the cheapest way. It's like I think at least 25% less expensive than building a new building and creating more publicly owned housing. And we can do things like social housing, like they have in Vienna, where 90% of folks are living in housing that's owned either publicly or by nonprofits, and people love it. But for the moment, if we want to have, not have the rising numbers of people on the streets, we're really going to have to do some housing assistance. And that's what's been cut at the federal level. I already talked about the state level, but at the city level too. I mean, I think they're spending a total of $75 million on shelters, but the new overnight only shelters, which are even less effective, are costing us $25 million this year. And he's only investing $5 million in housing assistance. And that's going to cause a massive problem. Basically, there was a great story in the Oregonian the other day where people were going out to know people's names on the streets and tout the new overnight only shelters. And they asked one woman about it, and she said that she had tried it and that there were no services there. And she wants to be in a place where she doesn't have to move every morning and change her space every morning, like she's already doing on the streets. And basically, without services, she thought that it was more work and trouble and danger than it was worth. You got to imagine what these places are like. It's people living like a few feet from other people on cots, with all their belongings under their bed and with all the things that come in the middle of the night. Like, I can't sleep with my mom. Like, she snores. Then to multiply that, and then the kinds of disturbances in the night, and it's just a turnstile situation. And even in the 24/7 shelters, if you're looking at how long people stay in shelters, the congregate shelters themselves, people spend about average of 50 days before leaving, and only 12% of them leave to housing. Whereas if you get somebody into permanent supportive housing or even the rapid rehousing, which is less intensive, you're getting a voucher plus a little bit of case management. 80% of those people are still housed 2 years later after their subsidy. So, the money is just much better spent. Plus, it's actually less expensive than the majority of shelter that we have in the city.
So more people are getting into shelter off the streets, and yet because even more people are losing their housing, the problem is just increasing, and the city is pouring money into these shelters, which don't solve the problem and just use up money that could be better spent in providing supportive housing, providing rental support, providing eviction defense, all the things that would keep people in housing and stop the
Right.
problem before it starts or accelerates.
Yeah. Whereas rental assistance would cost just a couple hundred dollars a month to keep someone housed and is the cheapest way to not end up with more houseless people on the streets. Eviction prevention is obviously the cheapest way. And that's what they've cut the most severely, both at the county level and the city level and the state level. And basically, that creates a situation where you've got more people living on the streets, which actually costs more, like thousands of dollars more a month per person to support.
And we recently have seen cuts to the county program for supportive housing services. They
Right.
re-indexed so that very wealthy people would pay a tiny bit less to lower the tax for the wealthy that they were paying. There was pressure for that from the Portland Metro Chamber,
Yeah.
from business lobbyists, real estate lobbyists.
Well, I need to be clear because the big change in funding this year had to do with the metro government did not predict well the amount of income there was going to be. So the tax cuts are coming next year that were already implemented, and we can go back to that in a minute. But what happened this year and what's been happening each year, the metro does a analysis to determine how much money they think they're going to be taking in. And each year it's been wildly off. But this year's budget deficit was related to just bad predictions. But coming up this year, we're going to be seeing a reduction in the tax on wealthy households with income over 150,000. Yeah, they raised it to 150,000. 2000 and up to something. And there's a lot of pressure to reduce it further. And this is in a situation where we've got cuts at the state and the federal level, and we can't afford to be doing this. Honestly, like for the families earning like $150,000, we're talking about the cost of a latte because it's only the money over $150 that they're paying for. So if you earn $160, you're paying a 1% tax on $10,000. So this is money well spent, and it's deeply needed, and it's the only thing that's going to protect us from the draconian things that are happening at the federal and even the state level. And it's foolish to cut off your nose to spite your face, I guess. I don't know if that's a good metaphor.
How do you understand that? Like, why is this happening? I mean, it seems like the mayor has gotten himself into this. He made a promise he's going to keep it, even though it seems not to be the right solution. And it seems like there are more sweeps happening. Houseless people are being displaced even more than in the past. What do you make of this? How do you understand why this is happening now?
Well, with the mayor, there's a focus on showing something quickly. You know, when we were back in the whole budget sessions, I heard from a lot of the folks on city council that he was elected on this. It was his mandate. And, you know, we're trying to point out if there's no money to move people into housing, if you're going to spend some money on shelter, you've got to have housing vouchers that match with that to move people through it. If you don't do that, then you're going to have more and more people unhoused, particularly when rent assistance and everything else and eviction prevention is going down. But there's just a real lack of desire. And honestly, like with the sweeps, we ask every person that comes into our hub, when was the last time you were swept? And the number saying within the last 2 weeks has gone from 45% to 67% in the last 6 months. So people are being moved and having their possessions they can't carry with them taken from them every 2 weeks. And you can imagine what that does to people's prospects for jobs, ability to get housing, ability to make appointments, and ability to keep hold of their medications. I mean, I had a guy lose his dentures. He lost his dentures in a sweep, and those can only be replaced every 10 years. So you're really talking about people just being dispossessed of the basic things they need to survive and possibly get themselves out of this situation. The mayor gave more than the people that do the sweeps, allocating more money for that and everything else except for his shelter only plan, his shelter overnight shelter only plan saw cuts. So it's really concerning because it just keeps people in constant motion and it keeps people going through the turnstile of shelter and then back on the streets. I mean, the average number of days that people were able to sustain being in shelter, and this includes the tiny house pods, is 77 days. Whereas people that are put in housing, 80% of them are still housed 2 years later. So you can do the math. And when we made a proposal to shift a lot of the money from this shelter-only plan to housing vouchers, and we calculated that we could serve in shelter and housing an additional 800 to 1,000 people than we could if we just did the shelter-only plan. And that's because rapid rehousing costs about 98% of what a 24/7 congregate shelter bed costs, okay? 60% of what a pod shelter costs, and 58% of what a motel shelter costs. So people don't realize, but those pod shelters cost approximately $3,000 a month. So
Which there are
those are the
apartments that cost that.
Exactly. Well, that's exactly right. So I have two guys that were housed like a year ago in $900 a month apartments. They're paying 30% of their income in rent. And one of them had never had a lease in his life. The other one had been on the streets for 14 years and they're doing great. One of them has been doing like super, like comes to work, does his thing. The other one has like gotten himself mental health counseling and has been able to get on bipolar medication that's significantly helped him improve his life, been able to get away from a domestically violent partner. I mean, these are all the things that can happen in housing that cannot happen in a shelter where you're living cheek by jowl with from 25 to 150 people. My third guy that got housed spent 2.5 years in a congregate shelter waiting for housing. 2.5 years. And I don't know anybody else that's been able to sustain that. And the stories he would tell every day when he came into work were, you know, a new outbreak of bed bugs. Somebody had screamed at him in the middle of the night. Somebody had stolen his things from under his cot. It's just, it's endless. So, like, people have to understand understand what it is to live in a congregate shelter with absolutely no privacy and completely vulnerable to the other 100 or so people that are in there.
Welcome Home did a study earlier this year that looked at various cities and the different kinds of responses they had, and that showed that the housing first model, where, as you say, regardless of what other problems someone has, they just get them housing and then they can deal with their illnesses, whatever else is going on in their lives, and achieve some stability, as opposed to cities that have shelter first models. Like Portland does. So in housing first models, the rate of unsheltered has gone down over the years with that policy, and it's gone the other way with the shelter model.
It's just much more effective. And I wouldn't call what we have here shelter first. Right now it's shelter only because there's no way out. There's no path out. And the new shelters that the mayor is setting up that he spent $25 million on, these overnight only shelters, they don't have services. Most of them don't even have showers. He's asking for people to volunteer to set up showers for people and stuff. And I'm sitting here going, well, we had all of our public funding cut, all of it. And we're scrambling to figure out how we're going to get through this next year. And meanwhile, the mayor's setting up things and then asking people to magically create the services that have
That
just
already exist.
that exist but have been, sidelined. So yeah, it's a pretty dire situation, especially when 27% of Portlanders are currently paying more than half their income in rent. And a lot of them are paying far more than 30% of their income in rent. And meanwhile, we've built all this new affordable housing, which is great, but a lot of it was set at 60% area median income, which includes all the people that own homes. So the problem is that people that rent don't have the same kind of income that the people that own homes. So a lot of those 60% AMI apartments are either vacant or they're in arrears because that price is only a couple $10 or $100 less than what people are paying for market rate rents right now.
So not particularly affordable by most understandings.
That's where something like eviction prevention and rental assistance could be especially important to preserving those buildings. Because if those buildings go into deep debt and arrears, we will lose that publicly built, publicly funded housing. So these are all points that we made to the mayor. And, just very disappointing to return to, we have to do this first. But no, we don't need to do that first because people don't need to go through a shelter to get to housing. People can go directly from the streets to housing. Like two of my guys did it. Two people that, again, 14 years on the streets, the other one never held a lease in his life. Not everybody can do that. And some people need permanent supportive housing, but there are a lot of people that are ready to do it and it costs less. It's more efficient. We'd serve more people. And just even the tens of billions of dollars that we're spending on sweeping people, all of those things are the result of this shelter only approach. Because even people that are sleeping somewhere overnight still have to be somewhere during the day. They're still going to be on the streets. You're still going to see them on the streets, and they're still going to have to find a way to eat and rest and do whatever they need to do. Like people don't realize people spend hours in line for food. They spend hours in their day going somewhere else to do their laundry if they can at a free space. They spend more time looking for going to apply for apartments or apply for assistance. Distance for apartments, all the things that people have to do, and the other thing about sweeps in particular is it creates a situation where people are looking to be more remote, more hidden. And what we found in a study we did last year with some PSU students is that the amount of incidence of frostbite and limb loss, fingers, toes, is higher the more that you sweep people, the more that you move them around constantly. They can't keep enough warm, dry clothing, and they're less able to go to get public transportation, to go to hospitals, et cetera.
People may already be aware, but the lifespan, life expectancy of people who are living unhoused is much lower. That and it really contributes to early death, to illness. And the Portland street medics noted that 80% of the people on the street have a disability. And then people are being swept and losing their medication, and as you know, getting frostbite.
Yeah, I mean, can tell a specific story of a patron who got tested at our place for hepatitis, tested positive, began her treatment. I think it's only supposed to take a couple of months to get free of it. It took us like a year and a half because every time she got swept, she lost her medications, her phone. And it got to the point where we were like coordinating with the Old Town Clinic Hep C people to be able to like hold on to her medication and hand them out one at a time so that she would be able to continue to take that medication. So, I mean, we're talking about the ways in which this seriously compromises, undermines people's health and ability to get healthy. And those aren't diseases that stop at the front door. A lot of those diseases are things that affect overall public health. So as long as we're treating people like this, the rest of us are also going to be impacted by this. It's all related. It's all tied in. And that's the thing is, you know, the other thing that Housing First studies have shown is that medical expenses, the costs of emergency rooms and public health are hugely higher when you're not housing people. Once people are housed, their medical bills go down. And that means a savings for taxpayers there too. And I guess going back to the sweeps plus shelter situation, is the mayor said it in his campaign speeches and he's still referencing it. And Councillor Zimmerman recently said it. The whole point of amping up the number of beds, technical beds that exist, is so that they can begin to enforce this camping ban, the ordinance they passed 2 years ago that the court said if you don't have places for people to stay, it's not reasonable to fine people and jail them for this. And so part of the impetus of this really is to create a situation where they can enforce a law that will cost us even more because jailing someone costs way more than housing someone. And yet people don't really connect the dots.
It does seem like there's a parallel between what's happening at the state and city level and what's happening nationally and the sort
Absolutely.
of vilification of houseless people and general criminalization and funneling of money into private detention centers and spending money on prisons rather than on the things that people actually need.
And rather than spending on things that improve the health and well-being of our entire community, this isn't just improve the lives of those on the streets. Bearing witness to people suffering, bearing witness to people in pain is something that impacts us all. And certainly the health costs are enormous. You know, lots of communicable diseases are being spread because we aren't giving people the wherewithal to keep themselves healthy. And again, this is not about peoples as individuals. This is about the fact that we're not providing the amount of housing we need at the prices we need for people to thrive.
It seems like the city's decision to look into social housing represents a positive step that
Yes.
presumably will take some time to bear fruit. But the idea of investing in public housing, in housing that will be there for the benefit of the community rather than for the profit of landlords or financial investors, it seems like a much better direction.
Yes. And now the cool thing about social housing is it's not just for low-income folks, it's mixed income. And the idea is that you want to create as much as possible so that everybody is able to afford to live in apartments that match their level of income. And the other cool thing about it is once you've purchased a building and you've paid it off, the rent goes down. In Vienna, you get a bill each month that shows the cost of maintaining the building, the cost of servicing the debt, et cetera, and there's also a lot of collective renter involvement and decision making over the properties. And there's a lot of attention to making sure that these are amenity rich spaces. So you've got childcare nearby, you've got medical clinics nearby, you've got grocery shops nearby, and green spaces, all of which, again, improve the overall health and well-being of people, not just the people that use it. It has its massive ripple effects. So social housing is super exciting, and it'll take us a long time to get to 90% of housing being in that place, but we've got to start somewhere. So I'm really excited about that.
The Capital News had a report a couple of months ago that calculated that there is actually ample housing in the state, maybe not in the city itself, but that Oregon does not actually have a lack of housing. What it has is a lack of housing that people
Affordable
can
housing.
afford. Yes.
Yeah. And even here, like in terms of talking about housing assistance, because housing assistance isn't only for permanently affordable housing buildings, it's for market rate units, right? I looked in a couple of months ago and there was like several thousand apartments that were within the range that we could make the difference for housing assistance. So, it's not a situation where we have to build or buy apartments in order to be able to have people housed. It's a mixture of investing in new public housing and also, supporting people until we get there, because we can't wait till we have all the permanently affordable housing that we need, because that's decades in the making problem.
But we can make a start for
We
sure.
can make a start. We can, and we are. Actually, really excitingly, the Portland purchased three buildings a couple of months back with, I think, a whole total of 224 or so units that are available now. And that's the exciting part about purchase too, is it's an immediate benefit. And it saves us money in housing assistance, because with rents lower, we don't have to pay as much to make the difference up from what they need in their income. So, yeah.
Well, for listeners who want to find out more, want to weigh in, take action, where would you suggest people look to get involved?
I think a great way to get involved is the Welcome Home Coalition, which is at welcomehomecoalition.org. And they have a Take Action page, they have a Get Involved page. This is an organization that is built of community-based providers largely and folks with lived experience. So I sit on the steering committee with folks that are currently housing insecure or have recently been housed. And it's a really great place to build advocacy for social housing, for renters' rights, and also to preserve the supportive housing services measure, which is under attack right now from mostly the Metro Business Chamber. So
But you think there is room to create some movement still on the supportive housing services measure?
we have a couple of ideas. They're not fully formed yet, but we will be working very hard to, I mean, not just preserve the tax and keep money coming into the coffers where it's needed, but also to improve the governance structure. But we're making some progress, but we need more voices in the room that know how it works and that want it to work better and that are focused on end user experience. Everybody else in the world, if you're creating a product, you don't just create a product without asking the people that are going to use it, how they use it, whether it works for them.
Sandra Comstock, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity. We've got to keep hope alive. We've got to keep it alive.
And we will. We can push back. We can get people housed. We can help the people who are in
Yes.
need now.
This is all possible. It's completely possible.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.